Hello, gorgeous listeners, and hello, my gorgeous elves.
Hi, babe.
Guys, welcome back once again to Straight Up, the pop culture podcast hosted by us journalists Kathleen and Ellie. I'm so excited to see your little face today.
Thank you, even though it's hailing.
Even though it's hailing, you are a ray of sunshine.
I am lighting up this room.
I'm excited to get into today's episode.
Scoop, guys. We are talking about Scoop first off. I'm so excited to hear your thoughts.
Let's do it.
We have waited a week or so that everyone could have time to watch it.
I've also refrained, as per, from WhatsApping you any thoughts because I don't want to cannibalise what we're actually going to say on air. So I really can't wait to actually hear what you thought about it.
So guys, for those of you that don't know, Scoop is the dramatisation of Newsnight's infamous Prince Andrew interview from 2019 with Emily Maitlis. I mean, do you remember watching that at the time?
It's honestly the most horrific car crash of an interview that I've ever seen. And I really, really enjoyed the dramatisation because it just reminded me how unbelievably just hideous the whole thing was from start to finish. And I mean that like in a kind of good way. I don't want to trivialise the very seriousness of the allegations around Prince Andrew, let me just say, but I did think that this particular dramatisation captures the absurdity of it all brilliantly.
Yes, I mean, it's really difficult because the interview itself made for the most entertaining TV. And after, even though it was harrowing, you know, the day after that Prince Andrew interview, it was like more memes than I've ever seen flooding Twitter. Like the Pizza Express woking thing, like memes were made of that for maybe like a week or two. Like it was insane. So it was that really weird situation where it was something so grotesque and obviously upsetting and difficult, but then did become this weird like moment of comic entertainment as well.
Because there's sort of excuses and reasons why he couldn't have been there and it couldn't possibly be him in the picture with Virginia Roberts and so on, were just ripe for comedy, weren't they? Him saying that it was almost impossible for him to sweat, as you say, these repeated references to being at a Pizza Express in Woking being the reason why he can't possibly have been there on an alleged date.
Didn't they also reply via Twitter, I'm pretty sure?
To who, Pizza Express?
Yeah.
God, I don't know. But the way he even says it, and Rufus Sewell, by the way, plays Prince Andrew just with a real flair and perfection that captures the reality, I think, of Prince Andrew so well. So Rufus Sewell, if you don't remember, is in many things, including he plays Jasper, Kate Winslet's character's love interest, in The Holiday.
Oh my God.
The toxic man prompts her to finally go off to LA. And
I mean, his physical transformation as Prince Andrew. He was wearing a lot of prosthetics.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Do you think his bottom is also...
That was awful.
Do you think that was his natural bottom?
So guys, if you've seen it, you'll know that there's a scene where he gets out of the bath and you do get quite the shot of the back.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that was a prosthetic because it was quite saggy. But not that Rufus Sewell's bottom might not be saggy. He's excellent in it. And actually, I liked what Wendy Ide said for The Guardian. I thought it was pretty on point. She said, it's not so much the physical transformation that so uncannily evokes the late Queen's purportedly favourite son, but the air of prickly, petulant delusion that Sewell captures. He's a man accustomed to cringing deference, something that he routinely confuses with respect.
My favourite scene in terms of just the sheer evocation of it and power was where he castigates a member of staff for not having his teddies in the right order on his bed.
Oh my goodness, that was absurd, wasn't it?
So the Duke's former maid, Charlotte Briggs, told The Sun in 2022 that Prince Andrew had a collection of over 70 cuddly toys, many of which wore naval uniforms, and that he was exacting about where he wanted them to be placed, and how his favourites, two hippos and a black panther called Daddy, Ducks and Prince, had to be placed more prominently.
Oh my good God.
And Briggs said, as soon as I got the job, I was told about the teddies and it was drilled into me how he wanted them. I even had a day's training. Everything had to be just right.
Wow.
It was so peculiar. She remarked, it was so odd. After all, he was a grown man who had served in the Falklands.
And he's got massive teddies specially organised on his bed. So I really like that scene because I think it just plays into how absurd Prince Andrew actually is as a person. But that scene, I know, has been kind of a point of contention for reviewers. The Independent, surprisingly, gave Scoop only a 3-star review. Clarice Loughery didn't love it. And she basically argues that scenes like that defang Prince Andrew.
Very
and
good
so
point.
By kind of infantilizing him like this, we take away from the actual seriousness of what's really gone on. And it kind of makes him look like this blundering, silly person rather than really honing in on the failure of the royal family as an institution in terms of protecting him.
Yes, so true. And I do think it also undermines finds his power, actually he has a lot of power, or he had a lot of power, and as you say, infantilizing him kind of undercuts that. When of course he was actually one of the most powerful people in the UK.
Definitely. So she writes, "We're never offered any real sense of the threat posed by someone living under the protection of the most powerful institution in the country." Mm. And I did think that was a fair point. That all said, though, I did really enjoy it. I think it was a really important point that the Independent reviewer makes, where she says that this is a film that is uncomfortably smug about a hollow victory, just because I hadn't thought about it like that. So she points to how Virginia Giuffre is only a name kind of merely mentioned in passing conversation, how Epstein's victims exist merely as a collection of terror-struck faces caught on camera by the New York Pap, Jay Donnelly, who's played by Connor Swindles from Sex Education. I did think he was good in it. He's the one who famously photographed Prince Andrew and Epstein walking together in Central Park in 2010. So the reviewer goes on to argue that Scoop instead considers its mic drop moment to be the scrolling wall of tweets at the end, when Billy Piper's character looks up at Piccadilly Circus and sees all of the disbelief that you've just touched on that was on Twitter when the interview came out. So by the way, guys, the dramatisation is an adaptation of the memoirs of Sam McAllister, who's the Newsnight booker who first secured the Prince Andrew interview. She is played excellently by Billy Piper. But The Independent argues that in doing this, it turns the collective battle to expose powerful abusers into an individualistic tale of a woman attempting to piece the elitist circles of the British media.
Yes, I definitely think it was that. And Peter Bradshaw said something similar. He said, "This is a laboriously acted and distinctly self-admiring, self-mythologizing drama about the media, the royals and the media royals." And he makes the point that despite the title, it wasn't really a scoop, because everything that we learn in the interview had already been established. None of Prince Andrew's quotes in the interview were revelations. It was just showing us how outrageously stupid he was. But yeah, there was basically no actual scoop from the interview.
Yeah, and I guess the actual research that Sam McAllister was putting in was all known stuff. It's not like she uncovered unknown narratives around Prince Andrew. She just pieced together the entire story.
Exactly that. So my thoughts were, I watched it and I was like, this is really watchable, especially because I'd been watching Ripley, and I so agree with you about that, by the way. I could not get past like half of episode one.
Okay, great. I was worried that I was just being a massive philistine, so that makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah, and I don't mind films that are in black and white, or TV shows that are in black and white. It was just so slow moving. And also I don't like hearing Andrew Scott with an American accent for some reason.
And I just wanted to see all the gorgeousness of the Italian Riviera in multicolour, you know?
Guys, for people that don't mind watching foreign films, I must recommend the
Ellie coming 1960 in with the highbrow record. Of course she is. Guys, can I just say how shocking it is that she doesn't like Ripley? You don't even like it. My God. Don't bother anyone.
Literally. So do watch Plein Soleil, which is the French adaptation with Alain Delon, and it's so good.
Okay.
And I really also didn't like the Matt Damon Ripley.
Oh, I love the Matt Damon Ripley.
I think it's because I'd watched Plein Soleil. It's called Purple Noon in English. But yeah, after I'd seen that, I just thought everything else was not as good.
Right, we're getting off track.
Back to Scoop. So I thought it was very watchable post Ripley. I was like, it's just something easy.
Some fun TV.
And I love watching Billy Piper. It's like,
she's excellent at playing like a slightly unlikable woman. Unlikable with air quotes.
She's so good at unlikable women. I Hate Susie, as we know. Yeah. And Sam McAllister is a very interesting character. However, I did that classic thing, of course, of then reading all the reviews and doing a lot of research about what her Newsnight colleagues, what Sam McAllister's Newsnight colleagues saw of the show and all of that. And after reading all of the discourse, I have now turned against it.
Okay, well, I did think your point last week was interesting about how quite a few journalists or people kind of within the media are feeling a bit disparaging about it because they don't see that what Sam McAllister did was actually that extraordinary. They're like, you're a celebrity booker. It's your job to book interviews.
You booked an interview. Yeah. One of my colleagues was like, it's film about booking an interview. Okay. We do that every day.
But I thought that was what was brilliant about the film, and that, yeah, it's about booking an interview, but it's fascinating.
Yes.
And showing the inner workings, not just of the BBC, but also of how that process actually plays out. You know, for the average person that doesn't work within the media, they might not know that the initial call-in came through the fact that the Prince was doing all of his like entrepreneurial stuff at the Palace.
Exactly.
And so therefore was inviting journalists in, and you know, how all of the groundwork was actually laid like a year prior to the sit-down itself in Newsnight.
Yeah. And also, even though I'm a journalist and so are you, it was still new to me exactly to see, as you say, behind the scenes of the BBC. I do think, and it's that classic bitter journalist vibes, I think everyone's just pissed off that they haven't had their, like, oh, why doesn't my hard work as a journalist ever get the celebrity treatment? Everyone's just annoyed that, like, this journalist has managed to get a whole Hollywood deal out of her very ordinary job, and they haven't.
So, yeah, I mean, one thing that the show does touch on as well is Sam McAllister as a kind of outlier at the BBC. The show hints that the BBC is a very elitist space where only a certain type of person can get through the door, whereas Sam McAllister, Billy Piper's character, has come from the Daily Mail. So she's got perhaps a more like tabloidy approach. And yes, like, they don't like that.
Yes. And so I read that that is very much fictionalized, which is very interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Yeah. Sorry, lost my train of thought there completely. Apparently, that's just not really true.
Exactly.
Insider sources in the BBC say. But then again, I suppose if you were an inside source in the BBC, you would say that, wouldn't you? You're not going to be like, yes, we made the woman from the Daily Mail feel like a complete outcast.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was a kind of reported piece in the Telegraph where my colleague Liam Kelly spoke to people who had worked with her, because they make a big point of how, like, oh, she was only earning like 10% of Maitlis's £325,000 salary. And they're like, yeah, but she worked part-time, you know, like, so yeah.
Well, as the booker as well, you're not going to get paid the same as the bloody
star
anchor,
presenter,
are
well,
you
also yeah that and one of them also said, an anonymous source, it's a nice narrative, the plucky, poorly paid woman. The truth is she worked part-time while Emily was the lead anchor of Newsnight. And also they said that she actually got on very well with her colleagues and that she fitted in really well because she'd done law. She was like highly educated, like very clever, and she fitted in like a glove.
Interesting.
Because yeah, they make a huge thing about this friction between Emily Maitlis and Sam McAllister. And Emily Maitlis comes across as like so condescending and like stiff. And I don't think, I mean, I don't know much about her, but I don't think she's that serious and that unlikable.
Gillian Anderson plays Emily Maitlis, and of all the actors in the show, she's the one that's got some flack, because I think people just feel that she played her classic stock Brit icy character. You know, it was almost indistinguishable from when she played Margaret Thatcher.
It was Thatcher playing Emily Maitlis. It was so weird. Why has she got her like Thatcher voice? The like low Thatcher voice. She hasn't shaken it. So weird.
I do quite like those little personal touches. So I had no idea that Emily Maitlis brings her greyhound into the BBC every day. That kind of insight.
So apparently she doesn't.
Oh, that's a bummer.
She's literally never brought her whippet in.
Oh.
So there was a fence piece also kind of myth-busting the show. And an anonymous Newsnight insider spoke to said she found the whole charade completely bemusing. Emily has been completely stitched up, they say. She's witty and jokey and cynical and energetic, not geriatric and husky and earnest and cold. And similarly, they said about McAllister, she's absolutely not an outsider. She's slick, a former barrister who fitted in well. I recall the deputy editors...
She's a former barrister? Yeah. Oh, they leave that out.
Yeah. I recall the deputy editors always saying nice things about her and her bookings.
God.
She's very much not like the plucky underdog that like had to go against the whole team.
With a totally new way of doing things.
Exactly. And so another insider told The Telegraph, everyone is so cross. The absence of Newsnight staff and
so
alumni
from
McAllister's book launch was very telling. So Emily Maitlis didn't go to the book launch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not that surprised.
And she didn't go to the film premiere either.
Do you know that Emily Maitlis is working on a rival show for Amazon? So let's see how that one's told. It'll be interesting to see the differing perspectives.
It's going to be called The Great Royal Scandal, I think. Oh, it's from the team that made A Great British Scandal with Hugh Grant. So a Newsnight, a snubbed Newsnight colleague said, fundamentally, it's a team game. But in her telling of it, as in McAllister, it's a one-woman show. I mean, I have to say, I do think that...
It is presented slightly like that. Like the rest of the team are just incompetent and focused on Nigel Farage and not getting any kind of real work done while she ploughs ahead with the real important work.
Exactly.
There definitely is a vibe of that.
But then Sam McAllister in interviews has also been very like pro Emily Maitlis. She's been like, I'm really excited to see her show. I hope she's excited to see mine. Like, I love seeing women be successful.
Yeah. And actually, I think this show definitely gives new life to what's already been a much parodied piece of television.
Definitely.
The independent reviewer I mentioned earlier, her issue with it also was she says it's all about who gets the credit for the story and not what the story's about. And to be fair, as you've said, in hindsight, having read the criticism, I do see that. I didn't get that while I was watching it immediately. But actually, that is quite jarring. So it's happy to revel in the most meme-y kind of bits of the interview. So camera cuts to like Billy Piper's face looking so embarrassed as it's playing out. But otherwise, as I said earlier, that she argues that the whole script just plays down the seriousness of Prince Andrew's malevolence.
Yes, exactly. And you get the sense, often, you know, that really kind of lame scene where Billy Piper is staring at those young girls on the bus, and you're clearly meant to think, look how much she cares about young women.
She's doing this because she wants to uncover sexual predators.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, do you, or do you just want like a good moment at work?
Yeah. Exactly.
Get a big pat on the back for who you booked.
Exactly that. I also thought the scene at the end where she's in the kebab shop, also that kind of thing of like, look at me, I'm always in the kebab shop because I'm a kind of working class single mother. I felt like they were maybe hamming up how she was not middle class, which is like fair enough if that is her background, but I felt like they were so unsubtle about it. It felt like cringe. And yeah, but yeah, there was that scene in the kebab shop at the end where she's watching the TV screen and the kebab shop owner is watching the TV screen as well. And then the kebab shop owner's like, God, imagine being there. And she goes, I was.
Oh, and yeah, that was quite cringe.
Sorry, as if the man running the kebab shop is going to be watching TV at the same time as you are in his shop.
Yeah,
and then you're both going to
have this.
Oh,
yeah.
Seen this.
And would that be playing at a kebab shop?
Also, I've never seen a TV,
in a kebab shop.
And also, it's not even a TV. It's like quite a big screen. And also, like, the back patting. I was there.
It was so back patting. And actually, I keep bringing it up, but that's why I love this independent review, because it made me see it through a different framework. Because as I've said, I genuinely did really enjoy watching it.
Yes.
But I think this review is quite right when she says, for example, at the end, that moment where the editor, Esme Wren, who's played by Romola Garai, says, this is what Newsnight is. We hold the powerful to account. Like, yes, granted, there's urgency to those words in the wake of the news that Newsnight will soon be shortened due to budget cuts and no longer be able to provide a showcase for investigative journalism. Like, that's a real issue. And as the reviewer says, there remain real questions about the mainstream media's ability to hold the powerful to account.
Yes.
But Scoop, which declares it a job well done simply to see a man stripped of honorary titles without ever having to defend himself in a criminal court, fails to make the argument for why any of this mattered beyond making good TV. That is bang on.
Yeah,
it's good TV and that's it.
Yeah. I found reading Sam McAllister's interviews from a few years ago when she was releasing her memoir, Scoops, really interesting just to know more behind the scenes of the Prince Andrew interview. So for instance, he thought it went really well.
Yes, I'd forgotten that. And I just couldn't believe that that is indeed what they all said happened. He was like, I think that went rather well.
Yes.
And was actually shocked to see the reaction. It's why he never asked for any kind of cuts, or there was no moment straight after the interview where the palace
was going to pull it.
Yeah.
Because the Queen's person recorded a backup, and so they thought, oh, she's going to listen to it.
And then the Queen's going to be like, hell to the no.
Hell to the no.
But he does touch on as well the fact that he'd asked the Queen's permission or her thoughts on doing the interview, and she said, I trust your judgment. I mean,
why would
his judgment was not to be trusted. So his press secretary, played by Keely Hawes,
yes,
Amanda Thirsk, I loved actually seeing, I guess, the palace's thinking behind why they ever thought this was a good idea, because it was so incomprehensible, wasn't it? When in 2019, the interview dropped, you were like, who ever said yes to this? Why? In what universe did they think this would rehabilitate his image? But actually, Keely Hawes' character is quite sympathetic, because you realise that she just massively was blinkered about her own boss.
She loved him.
She thought he was a great person, that everyone would see his real side, and like she did, and all fall in love with him. But also, bless her, she was slightly
deluded.
Yes.
And watching her, what I really liked about the show is when you watch Sam McAllister and you watch Amanda Thirsk watching Prince Andrew give the interview, and they're completely different reactions. So Billy Piper is like cringing beyond belief
and can't believe that she's almost been instrumental in this absolute
car crash.
Yeah.
Whereas Keely Hawes is like swooning.
He's doing really well.
We're doing really well.
Those accusations there. Yeah, quite right. He doesn't sweat. Like she bought all of his like reasoning, hook, line and sinker. And you just think, oh my God, this woman, like this poor woman. I actually felt sorry for her.
I know. So I was speaking to a colleague who has met her and knows her, and he was like, she's not that soft in real life. Like the dramatized, the
surely
representation.
Surely you wouldn't be that soft to have that job as well.
It makes her seem way more simple and less clever, basically. She's much
and
harder
floundering.
Than that.
Yeah, what to do? And she just lets Sam McAllister essentially like strong arm her into having him on Newsnight.
I found it really interesting that Sam McAllister's like really bold like pep talk to Andrew was real. So she literally said to him in real life that if he doesn't do a holds barred interview, then everyone's going to think he's guilty. And she said in this piece, I knew that calling him Randy Andy was risky, crazy risky even, but I felt that we had built a rapport. His life was on the line, you could feel that. And counterintuitively, I don't think he wanted deference. There was a lot at stake, and I think he was receptive to plain speaking from women. So that yeah. scene where we see him, see her like tear him a new arsehole was real.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And also what was interesting is Sam McAllister said in an interview in the Times that Prince Andrew actually offered Emily Maitlis a tour of the palace afterwards. That's how
that
well
did happen.
It. Yeah. And apparently they were like, couldn't believe that this was happening. And
because you think, oh my God, we need to run out of here right now. We need to make sure that footage gets back to the office so that yes. the palace can't physically pull it.
Literally, she said, I just thought, get the tapes and fucking run.
Yeah.
Cappers, I have been trying a new product from our faves at Innermost that I must tell you about.
Oh my God, yay! First though, a quick side note, honeys, because regular listeners will know that Innermost is the award-winning supplement brand that we've become converts to recently thanks to their amazingly healthy and nutritious proteins that are stocked everywhere from Ocado to John Lewis and Soho House.
Yes, we both love their plant-based protein, the health protein, which we've been raving about in our last few episodes, but I've since been trying the strong protein as I'm gearing up my weight training for summer, and I am amazed at how smooth and creamy it is.
Ooh, what flavour did you go for?
Strawberry. It's so delicate. It doesn't taste artificial like so many other proteins do, probably because, as well as the 34 grams of whey protein, creatine and magnesium, it also includes Montmorency cherries and bilberries, which help reduce inflammation and support cardiovascular health.
Yum, that sounds amazing. I personally just love how clean Innermost products really are. So this one is cruelty-free, vegetarian, gluten-free, contains no artificial flavours, no fillers, bulking agents or colours. The brand is just super transparent about their ingredients and they're all listed on the website, which I am obsessed with because it's really important, particularly in the kind of health and wellness space.
I definitely agree. I also love that their strength range is being marketed to women. Women who lift are gorgeous and beautiful and should be normalised.
Hell yeah, honey.
So go check out their whole range of products, including their protein powders, at liveinnermost.com.
Thank you so much to Innermost.
Another point from the interview from in the Times from May 2023, which I thought was good, was she talks about how if she had been Amanda Thirsk, she would have stopped the interview, and how in the past she's seen people's publicists or whatever literally stop an interview.
Yeah, that's what baffled me. Yeah. I mean, we've been in interviews where it's been stopped, like, yeah. you know, mid-record. I cannot fathom how someone from the palace didn't stand up during that interview as it started to go extremely left field.
Pizza Express Woking, I would have staged
someone an emergency. Needed to stand up and say, we're ending this now, this isn't going anywhere, we're going to have to pull this, I'm sorry, this isn't working for us,
yes.
this isn't an option.
Well, McAllister says, seriously, if he were my prince, I would have faked a fainting fit, pushed an emergency alarm button, or pretended he had to answer an urgent call and rush him out of the room. Unprofessional though that would have been, I can't envision not having stopped it.
No.
And then she says, that has happened to me in other interviews. An agent puts their hand across the camera lens or they just start shouting. It's rare, but full credit to them, they didn't. And that really is a miracle.
And the fact that they didn't just shows how utterly delusional Amanda Thirsk and the rest of the palace team really were.
I mean, in a way, it's like, okay, at least it absolves them in a way, because you're like, okay, you can't have thought he did it then. You really can't have thought he did it.
No, you didn't get the vibe that she thought he did.
No.
She genuinely thought he'd be able to save his reputation by just getting on camera.
Yeah.
Apparently she did lose her role as his private secretary, as you might imagine, after that.
Yeah.
And she also lost her role as the director of Pitch at the Palace, which was, of course, Andrew's entrepreneurial venture that we were talking about. But that is because the venture's corporate partner, including Barclays, all pulled out. So
yes,
apparently she did receive a 5-figure settlement with Buckingham Palace following her termination.
Oh, okay.
And now, would you like to know what she's doing now?
I would like to know what she's doing now.
She's got a senior business development role at JD.com.
JD?
Yeah.
JD Sport?
Oh, JD.com is a retailer in China. God, I didn't know that.
Meanwhile, Sam McAllister teaches negotiation.
Oh, I saw that in the ending credits.
Yeah.
She's a professor at like a uni now, isn't she?
Which I can fully see. I mean, she sounds like
an interesting woman. I'd definitely like to meet her. I mean, hats off to her. She did a bloody great job.
And I loved her like kind of trashy style that she wore very unapologetically.
Yes. I was concerned, however, that her hair looked a little bit close to mine for my own liking.
I think close to mine, like, more likely.
Oh my God, both of us, side parting and curly.
Yeah, and yikes. Also hers is blonde. So, but one thing I must say that was not working for her was the lip liner. What was going on there?
But don't you think that that was a calculated decision, as you say, to make her look, air quotes here, trashy?
Yes. And the big sunglasses.
And the leopard print coat.
I found it really fun to watch her.
Oh,
like,
I loved it. I thought she was so good.
Yes.
I think Billy Piper and Rufus Yule like make this show.
Yes.
For sure.
Definitely.
By the way, if you didn't know, I'm sure you'll know this, but for the honeys, it's directed by Philip Martin, who is the director of The Crown.
Yes.
So they obviously wanted a bit of his royal flavour.
And also, I did read one 5-star review in The Telegraph. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and you would have thought The Telegraph would be trying to back Prince Andrew.
I have to say, as much as I do love and respect our film critic, Tim Robey, who wrote it, we were all like, is he unhinged? After we all watched it, we're like, what?
5 stars.
Yeah, what the fuck?
I think 4 stars from Wendy Ide in The Guardian's Fair.
Yeah, it's a real marmite. I mean, it's really difficult as a someone who has a critic hat sometimes, but then is also like very simple in other ways. To differentiate between something that's watchable and fun versus a good piece
important.
Of art.
Yeah.
I think watchable and fun, maybe not a good piece of art.
It's maybe not moving like the moralistic needle in the way it could. I don't know.
But then again, neither did the Newsnight interview, one might say.
True.
Because as we've both said, we all knew all the facts and didn't actually...
Well, it felt funny more than serious,
yes.
Didn't it? Given the incredibly dark nature of... all of the allegations, not just against Prince Andrew, but everything that we know for sure about Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, it's like literally you do not get darker than that. More twisted. And I feel they didn't focus enough as well on the other celebrities included. So they mentioned BC being one of the names booked on the plane alongside Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein, which is obviously meant to be Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
But they could have brought a bit more of the kind of seriousness.
Yes, they could have.
That said, it's... as we always go back to, so subjective, because Wendy Ide sees the show as a film about tenacious female journalists striving to bring a man to account for his actions. She sees a parallel with the Maria Schrader's She Said, which is about the two New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story. And she argues that the series is perceptive on the dynamics of a newsroom under duress, which, in a way, is the direct opposite.
Yes.
Of what was argued in The Independent.
I also, as a journalist, I actually found it quite inspiring in that sometimes, because I have to book a lot of celebrity interviews, and sometimes I could maybe be more tenacious and be maybe more creative in the way that I'm trying to get them. So I actually did feel kind of like galvanized, like, okay, next time I'm going to think laterally and I'm going to fucking get that man or
yeah.
woman.
It was a real masterclass in nurturing relationships over a super long period of time, wasn't it? Because
and it pays off.
Conventional wisdom would be, oh, you want to get the talent, whoever they are, in the short period in which they're specifically promoting something. Once that's over, you've lost the opportunity or the peg and you're going to have to wait another year until they do something else that they want to shout about. But actually, I think this show really is testament to how these relationships are really long term and it takes years sometimes to actually get a conversation off the ground.
However, as someone who has had that job, as so have you, would you in a professional meeting with someone you've never met, i.e. the private statue to Prince Andrew, be like, let's get a real drink and then decamp to a hotel bar for Martini's?
Not. That was unhinged.
Yeah, like, no, that doesn't happen, guys.
Bringing her personal line...
yeah.
And those, I did feel it was overstepping a little bit, the reality of probably what the dynamic would be there, in particular with a flipping royal secretary.
Definitely.
It's not a random music PR that we are the same age as and have known for 8 years. This is the palace. That would be,
yes.
As we touched on in our episode about Kate Middleton, the absolute pinnacle for any British media institution to get a member of the royals to talk to you.
Yeah, and also I did find it weird, though, knowing that her bosses were being like not that keen on Prince Andrew at first.
But then maybe that's because Prince Andrew is the kind of reject of the family,
yes.
Even prior to
he
all
wasn't
of this.
The story then. Yeah, because basically because also this is the other thing, is that McAllister was ahead of the story. She thought that it was going to break.
Yeah.
And so she was like, he's not relevant now, but he's going to be. So
Jeffrey Epstein stuff is all going
to
explode.
Yes. So she was, to fair credit to her, she had a scoop in the sense that she had a feeling that a news story was about to break. And Newsnight needed it to be the news for it to work
relevant.
For Newsnight. Yeah. I have actually something kind of similar at the moment. I can't say who it is, but I have a white whale, as in like a celebrity I've been chasing for, I would say now, a whole year. And the PR, who's American, has been ringing me a lot to the point where
just
I'm like...
Just to chat,
to like talk about like how we're going to do it. Because basically he's quite controversial, the person that I've been trying to get.
God, that's a very American way of doing things, isn't it?
Yes.
I remember when I booked Wu-Tang Clan, it was 6 months of conversation prior
oh my
with
gosh.
Their American PR.
Yeah. Probably also because they knew that they'd be right.
Quite problematic, which
yeah.
they were.
Yeah.
So...
sometimes I still think about that often.
If you don't know, guys... I interviewed Wu-Tang. We were at a festival. Ellie came with me. And they invited us back to their hotel.
And also, we were in a trailer with them with the door shut with, like, what? There was, like, seven men and no PR.
And it was all quite boisterous, wasn't it?
They were all talking about, like, fucking women.
Yeah, we definitely got the feeling Wu-Tang have not got the memo about the Me Too movement.
Yes.
That was the overarching sense that we got.
Part of me is like, I wish we had gone back to the hotel room just to see.
I know, good story. Well, I'd like to go to the party just to check it out.
At South Kensington Hotel.
To be fair to them, I think age came into it massively. I feel that they were all in their kind of late 40s and 50s, and so genuinely hadn't quite got the Me Too memo.
No, but I do think it's... Also, they were kind of suspended in time in that they still thought it was appropriate to act like 25-year-old men in 40-year-old bodies.
Yeah.
In that they were so sexually boisterous. Anyway, so yeah, the guy that I'm chasing is quite controversial as well. So we keep having to have these like very serious conversations about the framing of certain questions.
Yes.
And so that was that. So actually, McAllister's been very useful in how I will continue to handle this.
Yeah. Based on her tips.
Yeah.
Funny.
So that's Scoop, guys. Let us know what you thought.
Yes. Are you in the 3-star, 4-star or 5-star camp?
Or 2 stars. The Observer gave it 2 stars, Peter Bradshaw.
Ah, okay. Well, honeys, let us know your thoughts as always.
I also read a piece that was about just generally this year, the mythologization of journalism, because Civil War has also come out, which I really want to see. The Alex Garland film about a dystopian Civil War in America. Have you heard about this?
No.
Oh, I think you'd probably like it.
Yeah, that sounds right on my street. Yeah. I love a dystopia.
Yeah, so basically it imagines America imploding through Civil War. You know, you're never told exactly who they are, who's fighting who, because I think they probably don't want to like incite hatred, but it's quite clear that it's probably like kind of Capitol riot vibes.
Got it.
And it follows Kirsten Dunst, who's a kind of like very weathered war photographer, going through America trying to get to the president to interview him, and it's like life or death situation. Like they encounter huge violence.
So yeah, it's a film. Sorry,
it's a film. Yeah,
and it's
film.
Coming out in the cinema.
It's in cinemas now by Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina.
Oh, I liked that.
Yeah, and but there have been similar.
Natalie Portman.
Yes, but there have been similar criticisms levied at that in The Guardian by Gillian Mumford with a piece called How Hollywood Fell in Love with Journalism. And she basically says that it's a perfume-scented love letter to journalists. And again, just like making it all about the hardened war reporters making their way across America to like do the right thing. And it really glamorizes their job.
Mm.
And so it's just maybe, I don't know why, for some reason everyone's like...
Is that new? Again, just to be devil's advocate, what about A Private War, the film based on Mary Colvin's excellent, excellent memoir? Mary Colvin being one of the most celebrated war correspondents of our time. She actually passed away in February 2012 in Syria.
And actually saying that, Spotlight was all about the journalists that uncovered the kind of Catholic Church paedophile priest scandal.
Yes.
And Bombshell, which is about the reporters at the New York Times who uncovered the Harvey Weinstein thing. So actually, yes, there are lots of films.
Yeah, I feel like every time
congratulating.
Every time journalists like uncover anything, it's made into some kind of feature film or series.
Which means there's hope for us yet, Cathers, with our hard-hitting journalism.
The real big scoops that we're getting over here.
Hey, we got a scoop once with Ed Sheeran's manager saying who really sliced Ed Sheeran's cheek.
We did.
Princess
That's
Beatrice.
True. We were actually a bit scared, guys. So ages ago, when we had Ed Sheeran's manager, Stuart Camp, on the podcast, he told us that this story that Ellie mentions, and it got covered literally everywhere. All the papers, BBC Radio 1. I was super paranoid that the Palace were going to come for us.
Yes.
We were going to get a letter about libel.
Scared.
Because the Palace, you do not fuck with the Palace. You know what
no.
I mean?
No. And also, like, I woke up that morning and my friend was like, Els, you're on Radio 1. Greg James played a clip with our voices on it. That was wild.
And I definitely didn't feel thrilled and exhilarated. I was freaking out. So...
I remember
being at the centre of that storm. I remember maybe not as fun as it seems.
Emailing a lot of outlets like Tatler and Forbes, being like, "Please hyperlink to our podcast."
Yeah, because at first everyone started covering it as an Sun exclusive. The audacity,
the actual fucking audacity. The Sun and Mail do this all the time. I remember when
they
I interviewed
it was their exclusive.
Yes. And I emailed them and I was like, absolutely not.
Straight up's exclusive, thank you very much.
Yes, credit and hyperlink, thank you. Also, everyone, whenever they write about me, which is not often, but if I'm ever...
I love how you say that like it's all the time.
They always refer to me as Eleanor Hall. which is really annoying. Actually, when I was working at GQ, I remember I was once bylined as Eleanor Hall, and I really got angry with the sub editors. I was like, I literally work in front of you and we are colleagues and friends. It's not that hard.
Well, I'm often Kathleen Johnson.
That is really annoying.
Yes.
But Johnson is a nicer surname than Hall.
I don't have beef with Hall.
You don't have beef with Hall. There are lots of Ellie Hall.
Yes, I get a lot of emails from someone called Ellie Hall, I think a PR.
So do I.
It always really confuses me because I often think it's you and then I'm like, oh no, wait.
And actually, Hugh, my nickname was Balls, which I still don't know. Is that okay?
Oh, I love that nickname.
I think it's funny.
Very fitting.
Yes, you're right. Okay, honey, let's talk about Amy Winehouse.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk about Amy Winehouse because Back to Black, the film by Sam Taylor Johnson, landed in cinemas last week. It's received quite a mixed response. I really, really wanted to go and see it this weekend. Full disclosure, I did not have time.
Me neither.
But I think that's fine because I'm sure lots of you honeys haven't seen it either. So I want to talk about all the very many interesting things that I've read around it. So many great articles. And plus, it is, of course, a kind of biopic. So there aren't, you know, spoilers.
Normalise not knowing everything.
Exactly. So as I say, it has had a very mixed critical response. It's nearly 13 years on from Amy's death, which was from alcohol poisoning. And quite a few fans feel that it's just too soon and that perhaps not enough time has passed to cover her life in this way. I'm inclined to slightly agree because while I think Marissa Abella has had stonking reviews for her portrayal of Amy, Amy was this huge, larger than life cultural figure that is very difficult to encapsulate by anyone. And I think, you know, when we talk about something like the Elvis biopics, it's been such a long time before anyone's really had a direct experience of the real man himself. You can buy an actor's rendition of it. I just think it's impossible to capture Amy's magic, and no actor, no matter how brilliant they are really accurately going to genuinely feel like her to the audience. You know, our idea of who Amy Winehouse is, what she looked like, is so deeply entrenched.
Yes.
That any depiction is going to fall a little bit short.
I agree. And I have said this before, but I do think the only person I could totally imagine at least having a decent shot at it is Ray. Something about her like gobby charisma and obviously her amazing voice, that I was like, she could maybe capture that. Listening to Marissa Abella sing in the trailer, I was like, you've got a perfectly nice voice, but you have none of the richness or timbre of Amy. Like, it just doesn't compare.
No, it doesn't. And fun fact, originally, Marissa was not meant to be singing in the film. The original plan was to use Amy's actual vocals. But Marissa did loads of prep. Actually, some of it secretly. She took guitar and vocal lessons 4 times a week for 3 months, showed her progress to Sam Taylor Johnson, and they decided to integrate Marissa's voice instead. Well, I see why people haven't loved that, because again, much like with Amy's charisma and magic, you're never going to have the voice. And so it's always going to make the film feel a little bit insincere or untruthful or not accurate, you know? Inaccurate, I should say.
Yes. I do respect the graft, though.
I really respect it. And I love Marissa Abella. So if you don't know, guys, she is Yasmin from Industry, the HBO BBC drama all about the city, which we really liked.
We did. Also, I wondered what your thoughts were on her losing a lot of weight for the film, because I personally feel a bit uncomfortable when actors have to lose a lot of weight for parts, even though I understand why sometimes it's necessary to fully portray someone. But I'm just I just think it's so risky.
I agree.
Even though they do it within healthy parameters with like a coach and whatever. But I read in the Evening Standard, you've probably read that eviscerating review as well, that the writer says that like neither her nor Blake's character, played by Jack O'Connell, are anywhere near skinny enough. They look healthy slim when actually in reality, Amy and Blake both looked like grotesquely malnourished.
Yeah, so one of the major criticisms levied at this film is that it kind of sanitizes the reality of Amy's drug and alcohol addiction, and also, I guess, the relationship. So this film is ultimately a love story about Amy and Blake Fielder-Civil. Mm. So if you don't know, again, honeys, their relationship provided the inspiration for Amy's most famous piece of work, the Back to Black album. So Jack O'Connell's got lots of charisma. His kind of rendition of Blake has gone down really well, and that's made a lot of people feel very uncomfortable. You know, Blake is someone that has actively admitted to introducing Amy to crack and heroin.
Exactly.
And he was an awful force in her life. And I think the film, in showing their relationship as a gorgeous love story doesn't account for the real toxicity that existed there. And in a way, the weight thing, I think, reflects that exactly.
Yeah, so in the film, the fact that he introduced Amy to drugs is airbrushed out. And in fact, there's one scene where he tries to get her off it, which again just misrepresents the very bad influence he actually had on her.
Yeah.
I read quite an interesting interview with Jack O'Connell about playing Blake, and he is very kind to Blake. He says, "To suggest that Blake is everything we read about him and think we know about him, I think that demeans Amy as well. I think it's very clear with Amy that she had a fucking genius mind. There was a level of genius to her work, and I don't think she would let anyone walk all over her, not in the way that's depicted in the press."
I mean, that's actually a really fair point.
It is a fair point, but I think lots of genius, clever women, remember Andrew Huberman from last week, can be manipulated if they're in love.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And she was a huge romantic, that's for sure. And definitely a very fragile person.
Of course. Like, yeah, she was a genius, but she was also a drug addict. I mean, by his logic of, if you're a genius, you're strong-minded and you're not going to get walked over. Well, she was a drug addict, so there's vulnerability there.
Yeah, I think even just describing her as a drug addict kind of doesn't account for the deep complexities that come with that illness. Mm. So Amy was a very damaged person. There was a lot going on in her life. She struggled with eating disorders. She had bulimia. She'd obviously had real struggles with addiction. And she'd also, you know, struggled with depression and anxiety, self-harm as she was growing up.
Yes, when I went to see the Amy Winehouse exhibition at the Design Museum, I think it was 2 summers ago, had lots of her diaries open. And I thought it was so moving, but I was struck about how obsessed she was with kind of changing herself and self-improvement and things she wanted to change about herself. She was quite clearly very prone to self-hatred.
Okay, gang, I've just got back from Mexico and I need to tell you about how amazing it was to be able to bring my London Nootropics adaptogenic coffee sachets there with me. You all know by now how much we love London Nootropics, but honestly, you honeys that haven't yet tried it have got to stock up before the summer holidays, because I promise you will be converted.
And we have a discount code, so keep listening.
We do. So I packed about 30 sachets for Marlon and I for our 2-week holiday, and it was honestly absolute heaven having one every morning, sat on the balcony reading while the Airbnb instant sat sadly in the corner. It also made me feel so good in myself every day.
Stunning. I am definitely going to do the same, and I also go to Mexico later in the year. Which blends did you bring, babe?
I actually brought a mix, so we could choose each day depending on our mood. Guys, if you don't know, then adaptogens are basically natural plant extracts that massively enhance our well-being, and each London Nootropics blend utilizes different ingredients of the absolute highest quality for different purposes. My OG favors flow. You all know I love lion's mane, but I wanted to have enough for those days while also bring mojo, because it's so helpful. The cordyceps in it is shown to rapidly reset our body clock, and so it really, really helps with jet lag.
You know that's my absolute fave. I literally cannot go to the gym without it anymore.
I also brought the Calm Blend with L-theanine for the mornings when I'd had a few too many margs the night before and was feeling a little bit anxious. So that was very handy, can't lie.
Classic. Guys, upgrade your coffee game like us at londonnootropics.co.uk using the code STRAIGHTUP, all one word, no caps, for 20% off at checkout.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner, London Nootropics. Blake now lives in the north of England, and he popped up on daytime TV last year to say that he'll always carry a burden of guilt for Amy's death, but that he wasn't solely to blame for her addictions. It's hard, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, he is the one that introduced her to hard drugs. Her dad, Mitch, has said that one of her kind of catchphrases prior to meeting Blake was, "Class A drugs are for mugs," and she'd constantly repeat it.
Yeah. I mean, this is also why I had a problem with the film as soon as it was announced. I saw that it was definitely in kind of collaboration, or rather it had been co-signed by her parents and Mitch Winehouse, her dad, who I have a real issue with because I think he kind of launched his own music career off the back of Amy's and did this fucking weird documentary where she was meant to be recovering, I think, in the Bahamas.
In St. Lucia.
Oh, St. Lucia, yeah.
She had recovered. She'd come out of rehab. She went to St. Lucia to get clean, and he followed her to St. Lucia with cameras to make a documentary about, like, my daughter Amy. So, Huns, if you haven't seen it, the documentary by Asif Kapadia about Amy, titled Amy, is such a powerful piece of storytelling, and it actually paints Mitch Winehouse in a pretty damning light.
Yeah.
The documentary basically levies that Mitch was somewhat absent in Amy's life until she became famous, and then suddenly he wanted a piece of the pie.
Exactly.
Amy's parents, as you say, are executive producers on this movie, which is why it makes complete sense that Mitch is painted in a far more kind of empathetic light. He's played by Eddie Marson, and their relationship, the father-daughter relationship, is actually depicted to be, you know, wholesome, whereas the documentary pitches the idea that Mitch is responsible for much of Amy's inner turmoil.
Yes, exactly. And I wonder as well if Mitch trying to airbrush his own image is also why Blake's was kind of airbrushed, because I think Blake and him were lumped together a bit in terms of the like malevolent forces in her life.
I read a fascinating piece by Laura Snapes, former guest of the pod, in The Guardian that I've been dying to talk to you about because I think it's so important. So in an opinion piece for The Guardian, Laura Snapes argues that it's a grotesque insult for Back to Black to suggest that Amy Winehouse died of heartache over her childlessness. She says that the biopic suggests that the singer's desire for a baby was the main source of her suffering, and that this is a gendered simplification that exonerates the forces that killed her.
Mm.
The film definitely suggests that Amy was desperate to be a mother. One of the main quotes in the trailer that's included is Amy saying, "I wasn't put on this earth just to be a singer. I want to be a wife and a mum." And Laura Snape basically argues that this very shallow telling of her life is the latest injustice meted out to Winehouse. Laura argues that it's a regressive retreat to damaging tropes with a focus on Amy's self-destruction that handily exonerates everyone surrounding her, bar the convenient bogeymen of swarming paparazzi and clueless men from the record label telling her what to do, who the director can count on any faintly Britney literate viewer to understand as the bad guys. And it undoes much of the work done to establish a fair and desensationalized understanding of the singer since her death. She argues it's voyeuristic about her pain, reveling in Marissa's shocking thinness and scenes of her stumbling through Camden with the grimly, you know, the famous bloodied ballet pumps, with kind of annoying attempts at symbolism like a caged songbird, rather than actually making an authentic attempt to understand where all this pain really came from. Back to Black suggests this very tenuous truth that at the centre of Amy's torment was her being desperate to have a baby, and that actually it was this like inability to conceive that killed her.
It's really difficult because I think Amy's character is so engulfed within this really gruesome and like miserable, gloomy narrative, when actually if you watch interviews with her, she was fucking funny. She was such a funny woman. If you watch her like on Jonathan Ross or like in doing other interviews, and if you speak to people that know her, so we know her publicist Shane, or I've spoken to her former manager Nick Szymanski, and they always remember just like how whenever they went to award shows, if they ever went to an event, she'd be so inappropriate. She would say such funny things about people on stage, or like, yeah, she'd always just be like making mischief, making everyone laugh at things they shouldn't be.
Yeah, so in terms of the kind of inappropriate commentary, Laura argues, here is one of the greatest artists of the 21st century who wrote such sexual, bawdy, lacerating songs about womanhood, being sanitized by a narrative of legible female pain. Never mind trying to make sense of all that messy business. Let us soothe our consciences with the banality of her craving a baby.
Such a good line.
Isn't it? I thought this piece really taps into why it's such a problematic narrative to hone in on the idea that her want to be a mother was the kind of sum total of her parts, instead of really focusing in on her music. I mean, that's what I loved about Amy. You get to see her notebooks, her writing process. It really championed her musical influences.
Definitely.
I think what you've said, though, in terms of people that knew her is absolutely right. I read a review by Will Hodgkinson, the Times critic, who says he knew Amy, and he says that he really kind of admired Back to Black for going beyond the tragedy and delving into the character within. And he said that the Amy portrayed by Marissa felt very true to the mischievous, fun, soft person that he knew. So yeah, as a friend reviewing, Will Hodgkinson says that Marissa's portrayal of Winehouse evokes her blend of toughness, sweetness and single-mindedness. And although the film fell into the trap of dramatic exaggeration so typical of biopics, it also felt more true to her spirit than Asif Kapadia's documentary Amy, which came with such a strong narrative agenda, they ended up not trusting it. Back to Black captured who Winehouse was, not just what happened to her.
That's a nice quote. Well, that does make me even more intrigued to go and see it and form my own judgment.
So I guess it really is a tricky one because, of course, it's capturing some essence of Amy that the people that knew her felt was there. But I am inclined to agree with Laura Snapes that centering that narrative as the entire thrust of the film feels very flattening to Amy's actual womanhood. You know, she says, moreover, the idea that Winehouse's highly specific intersection of chemical, psychological and social problems can be boiled down to her supposed inability to become a mother is a rank gendered simplification. You know, she says that attempting to make an extraordinary woman who was the victim of extraordinary circumstances tragically relatable in this way is an insult to Amy Winehouse's complexity and the imperative of remembering all the factors that contributed to her demise. And I think one really important part of the film, so if you do want to watch the film and you don't want to hear anything about the ending, skip forward quickly now because it is a bit of a spoiler. But the film ends with Winehouse clean and divorced, waving her dad off outside her brand new home. It makes no mention of the fact that she was actually engaged to another man by this point. And it shows her heading indoors being provoked by a pap who asks if she has any messages for Blake Fildersivel's new girlfriend and their new baby. So she finds out that Blake has had a baby with his new partner. Distraught, she goes upstairs and is singing to herself in the mirror. The film then ends, cuts to black, and states that Amy died on the 23rd of July 2011 from alcohol poisoning, followed by a period of sobriety. So massively insinuating that she had a relapse because of this news about Blake.
Yes, and I think there's something really icky about the suggestion that it might have been self-inflicted and that that comment drove her to kind of drink herself to death. And also, I think when people do potentially die by their own hand, I think it's literally like Samaritan's guidelines that you're never meant to say in your reporting, for instance, like the one reason why they might have chosen to do that.
No, because there isn't a one reason.
Yeah. Exactly, there's never one reason.
Real.
And it's really irresponsible for other people in very vulnerable states to read that and to kind of correlate and to maybe relate to that one reason and then think, okay, that's the outcome that I should take. I also read a review in the Evening Standard that said it was really irresponsible because for some people who may be in the alpha generation or people that watch it in 20 years from now will take that Amy as face value and see her as a completely different person to what she was.
Yeah.
I read a couple of years ago Tyler James's memoir called My Amy. He lived with her.
Yes,
for ages.
The very good friend.
Yeah. And tellingly, he very much fell out with Mitch. I don't think he was in any way involved with the film. And it's just such a warm, like sparky book about their friendship and really did convey Amy as like a real bubbly, amazing, larger-than-life character. It's not like the best written book ever, but in a way, the like conversational, simple style makes it feel even more real.
I just loved how she came across in the documentary. I think it's going to be pretty hard for another filmmaker to even come close to that. I thought it was a really kind of full, nuanced and beautiful portrayal that I think most people in her life, other than her parents, have kind of said felt true to the reality of the situation.
Yeah, you have to think, like, why is Sam Taylor Johnson doing that? Okay, yes, she says in interviews that she's doing it because she wanted to honour Amy's memory. But, like, come on, that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it because you want money and acclaim. That's why you're doing it. You're not actually doing it to honour Amy's memory. That's what you say in interviews.
So I read an interview with Sam Taylor Johnson in The Guardian where she talks about art, age gaps and Amy Winehouse and says that filming sucked me to a place I didn't know how to get out of. She argues that Back to Black is probably the best thing that she's ever done, even though she has a soft spot for Nowhere Boy, her John Lennon biopic, which came out in 2009. It was her first feature and it's also where she met her husband, Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's 23 years and her junior. I guess I did find it compelling to think about the similarity in their life insofar as they've both had a relationship that's been pawed and picked over, not only by the media, but also by strangers.
That's true. Yeah, being a lot of judgment about the age gap. I do feel sorry for Sam Taylor Johnson in that I do think, yeah, she also as a director has been rinsed by the media because of 50 Shades and she really fell out with E.L. James, E.L. James being the writer.
Yeah, so
She's had a rough time with the media herself, it's true.
Yeah, and I think she has said several times she wanted to make a film that captured Amy's essence, perhaps in a softer way. And it was about the viewer wanting to go home and put Amy's music on straight after.
That's true. And I have seen that her label, Island, are now like putting out a lot of her old music and like new ways, like new vinyl, like remastered vinyls or whatever. So I think they are very much trying to keep the legacy of her music alive, as you say. But again, just a cynic in me is just like, is that really why Sam Taylor Johnson is doing the film? Because she wants people to go and listen to Amy's music.
Yeah, me too. I also read a really great piece in the Sunday Times this weekend titled The Row Raging Between Amy Winehouse's Father and Her Best Friends. And I think the portrayal of Mitch here is testament to perhaps the fact that the documentary's telling of who he really is slightly more accurate than Sam Taylor Johnson's. So Mitch Winehouse is suing two of Amy's closest friends over money from the sale of her possessions. It's a really bizarre story.
Is Tyler James one of them?
No, it's Naomi Perry, who is now 37, and Catriona Gourlay, who's 41. So basically what's actually happened is that Mitch last year accused the two women of selling valuable property, mainly clothes and other collectibles, that he says belonged to the Amy Winehouse estate, which he administers. But they argue that Mitch had given them his blessing to sell these things. The estate had known that this massive auction was going to go ahead. And also the items they sold were personal items that Amy had given to them. So Naomi, for example, who lived with Amy in her first house in Jeffrey's Place in Camden, which was the house she bought outright with the proceeds from her first album, Frank, in 2005, Naomi designed a number of Amy's stage clothes. So she designed the bamboo motif dress that Amy wore in what would be her final concert. So you know the one in Belgrade, yeah, in Serbia, the very famous, awful,
where she kind of collapsed.
Yeah, she was too drunk to perform. And then over a month later, she passed away. Amy actually gifted Naomi that bamboo dress afterwards. And she had been the designer who made it. So the women both had various personal items. One other listed item was a Moschino bag. The friends were so close to Amy that they were actually even asked by the family to dress her body for the funeral. So this isn't just some randos in her orbit. You know what I mean? These are two very, very close friends. I don't think they're people that would want to take financial advantage of the estate. And they have made money from it. I believe the overall amount is about £730,000. So it's a big amount of money. You can see why Mitch is suddenly wanting to pursue this. But I also think it's super rank what he's doing.
Yeah, but what are your thoughts, though, on them selling the possessions in the first place?
Well, I think this is what the piece gets into. The possessions that they've sold are, in fact, items that Amy gifted to them, and they're things that they just can't properly look after. They need to be in museums. So of the kind of inventory at auction has gone to a museum because it's items that need proper storage. As Naomi says, she shouldn't be storing these dresses that are literal pieces of British cultural history in a cupboard in her mum's house in Wales.
Yes, it's different to like her selling like a letter that Amy sent her. Or yeah. That would feel really icky, like things that you want to treasure yourself at home and that are private. But yes, you're right, selling dresses that you would only damage by having in your house and selling it to a museum, that does feel acceptable.
Yeah, however, I do know what you're saying. There was something right at the beginning of the piece that I was like, best friends selling items belonging to Amy suddenly, you know, over 10 years after her death. Why are they doing this? Whereas the piece does get quite upfront about the fact that part of the reason is because they need money. Like, Naomi has had really poor mental health and struggled a lot since Amy's passing, and it's had a huge impact on her life. And she kind of says, yeah, I need the money.
Would you be upset if you passed away and I sold some of your expensive possessions?
Well, this is it. They very much feel that Amy would not mind and would have wanted them to do this. And I would be inclined to agree. I don't think Amy's someone that would have given a shit about.
No, I think she'd been like, absolutely, treat yourself, yeah, go on holiday with my dress.
And yeah, I'd much rather you sell my possessions and have a nice life off the back of it and be able to look after yourself after, you know, a decade plus of a lot of emotional turmoil. That I would you be broke and keep it in a cupboard where no one can see it anyway? What the hell's the point of that?
Exactly. I do agree. I think maybe if they were selling, really personal letters, I'd be like, don't you want to keep that? Why would you want to share that with the world?
Also, perhaps telling, Naomi and Catriona are not featured as characters in Back to Black. Don't know how much he would have actually had to do with that, but he does now. Mitch spends most of his time administering the estate. So Amy did earn a lot of money, even though she spent a lot of money. Allegedly, at one point, she was spending £1,000 a day on drugs, and she once blew £500,000 on a bill
God.
For a hotel in St. Lucia. And she would also be tapped up for like pocket money from Blakefield or Civil. She also reportedly spent £1,000 a month on her kittens and was very generous with lots of friends. So she spent quite a bit, but her parents were left with £3 million after tax after she passed away, which was largely the value of her house, the big swanky Camden Square house. However, millions in royalties since her death have made the estate much more money. Some of that goes to family members. Mitch says, what she's done is she set her whole family up, but a large portion is used to fund the Amy Winehouse Foundation. About £4 million so far has gone to that foundation. So if you don't know, the Amy Winehouse Foundation supports young people that are struggling with addiction. There's a bricks and mortar space, Amy's Place, which provides housing for vulnerable young people struggling with addiction.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so it's doing really amazing things, but my overall instinct is calling bullshit on Mitch in that I don't think he wants the money to go to the estate so that it can go to the charity. I think he's just greedy as fuck and he wants it.
I totally get that.
He's bad vibes. I absolutely agree with everything you said. And I am inclined to support the narrative sold in Amy. I mean, even the song Rehab says.
Exactly. My daddy thinks I'm fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, what an irresponsible move to have made on his behalf.
I mean, I think I also feel for Amy because I think that she would hate the hatred that her dad has got. Like, I think she loved her dad.
Definitely.
And so I do feel also that she would be horrified. No. So I think this is the problem with fame. There is just everyone wants to tell their side of the story and get a piece of it and be
everyone
in the
sees
narrative.
It differently. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what I will say to back the two friends again is that I think the Sunday Times piece makes it clear that they were coming from a place of incredibly good intention. Everything was run very much kind of above board. They worked with a respected auctions business called Julian's Auctions, which is based in Beverly Hills, and it specializes in music and showbiz memorabilia. There was a list of potential items emailed over to Jane Winehouse, who's Mitch's second wife, who he actually just divorced last year, but she does much of the administration for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. I don't think that Catriona and Naomi were trying to hide this from the estate in any way.
Oh, it makes me feel sick.
It's annoying, isn't it?
Really annoying. That's so interesting, though. I actually hadn't read that piece.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece. I'll pop it in the show notes, of course. I think the case is going to take years to unravel. Mitch, of course, is adamant that the women should hand back the money that he believes belongs to the estate. He went to the police about the case.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but I think the police said that because he'd initiated proceedings already in the High Court, it was a civil matter. The journalist asked Mitch, do you want to see your daughter's friends get sent to jail? And he says, no, that would be horrible, crazy. However, if his course of action is successful, both women are likely to be made bankrupt and they might go to prison.
Oh my God, like Amy would hate
yeah,
that. Oh
surely
my God.
Amy would absolutely despise that.
Also, I know this is completely irrelevant, but he just has a cruel face. Like, he does not seem like a nice man when you watch him talk and you see him.
No, he doesn't. And just launching his own music career.
He made them perform together. I think they did like a gig and stuff together, and it was probably him that like strong-armed her into that. I mean, she was probably like delighted to perform with her dad, but yeah. You can't I feel like with his motivations there's always something really mercenary about
he wanted to be in the spotlight. I feel like that.
Is anyone listening to his jazz album? I would like to know.
No, I read an old interview with Nick Szymanski as well, yeah. Her first manager, who you mentioned earlier, and he talks about how the Amy film felt truest to what happened when he was really there, which I took to have a kind of subtext about the portrayal of Mitch.
Definitely. God, at some point they just need to kind of let her legacy rest, I think.
I do think though, particularly considering that Sam Taylor Johnson was actually the director of the adaptation of James Frey's addiction memoir, A Million Little Pieces, she could have done a bit more to actually investigate the complex reasons that Amy was so unwell. Without making it a really kind of dark tale, we can still celebrate her music, focus on the joy and happiness that there was in her life at times. But I don't think it does justice to the reality of what happened.
Yes, and one might say that since she's not here, no one can ever really know what those are. Like, you
exactly.
can't actually capture that without hearing it from the horse's mouth. And so we'll never know. And it can't actually be rendered on screen.
Yeah. So it's a project that was always destined to court a lot of controversy, I think.
But I'm excited to see it.
Me too. Even having done all of this research around it, it hasn't put me off. I'm actually more excited to see it now than I was prior to reading anything about it.
So, Kath, is to finish, favourite Amy Winehouse song? Mine is To Jar on Their Own.
Oh, okay. Mine's definitely Back to Black. I know it's so obvious, but
it's a fucking good song.
Too good. I spent many a day as a teenager who's probably way old to do this, probably 18, singing Back to Black on karaoke on the Nintendo Wii. What do you call it? You know, the karaoke
yes.
on Wii.
I've never played it, but I know what you mean.
God, I'm never going to remember the name of it now, but Back to Black was on there. And because I have such a deep, husky voice, it was one of the only songs that I could ever actually do and win points on.
Oh, you do have a gorgeous,
so
husky voice.
Kept her.
A special place.
A special place in my heart since then. Do you remember where you were when you heard the news of her passing?
No, I don't actually.
I do. I feel like it was one of those real moments. I was in Greece on holiday and it was so shocking because everyone couldn't believe that she would have passed at 27 given the kind of 27 club.
Yeah.
Idea.
I do find it wild that that is genuinely a thing.
So guys, if you don't know, the 27 club is the name given to a kind of informal list consisting mostly of popular like musicians, actors, artists and other celebs who died at the age of 27. So it
Kurt
happens
Cobain.
A lot. And I guess there's kind of almost conspiracies around it. People look at the statistical spike and ask why this is a cultural phenomenon. I mean, many of the celebrities that died at 27 are noted for their sort of high-risk lifestyles.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of them did do a lot of drugs. Okay, guys, let us know what you think of the film. If you've seen it, do shoot us a DM at Straight Up Pod. And please leave us a review on Apple and a rating on Spotify. And we will be back same time next week.
We will. There are so many things I want to talk about. We haven't even touched on the Bridget Jones 4.
No, or Salman Rushdie's memoir, which I really want to get into as well.
I also really wanted to talk to you about Jojo Siwa. I wanted to talk to you about Suki Waterhouse and Robert Pattinson's arrival.
Yes, I want to talk about Nicola Peltz's tone-deaf film, Lola, where she cosplays a poor person.
We also never spoke about Anne-Marie being married to Slow Tie, having recently had a baby. That was a shocking bit of celeb news.
I mean, we need to have a daily podcast, yeah. Clearly. Guys, if you would like us to do that.
There's too much to cover. One final recommendation that I'd like to leave you with, honey. Because yes. I know how much you love Aubrey Plaza.
Yes.
Is to watch Emily the Criminal on Netflix tonight.
Oh, yes. I've heard good things.
It's great.
Well, I'm actually going to a belly dancing lesson.
Oh, my God. You're going to tell the Huns. Guys, Ellie has signed herself up for a belly dancing class.
This is class 2 tonight. I'm having an unhinged period of my life, and that is part of it.
Can we bless the feed with a picture from your belly dancing?
On my 4th, because it's a course of 4, when I get to a point where I'm not mortifying myself, which I'm afraid I am currently, because they do send us a video of us dancing at the end of each lesson, and I was like, holy hell, I'm bad. But hopefully by class 4, I'll be better. Anyway, so yeah, I'll report back.
Great. Thank you, honey. Enjoy your week, honeys.
Bye.